You're listening to Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today. And coming up, are you quiet quitting? Perhaps you're quiet firing. Either way, Carla Miller from The Washington Post will cover the contentious dynamics, both old and new, in the workplace. Now, if you ever watched the HBO show Game of Thrones, or the new one, Dragons, House of Dragons, and saw a character literally losing their head, chances are that severed head was made by a Wisconsin prop company. Dapper Cadaver started in Los Angeles, now based in Madison, where they supply all sorts of fake corpses, bones, and creepy dolls. Their creations have been used in thousands of television shows and movies, plus amusement parks, haunted houses, escape rooms, and maybe even in your own Hollywood Halloween designs. BJ Winslow and wife Eileen own the specialty prop shop Dapper Cadaver. BJ, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
The first question that comes to my mind is, when you're in a social gathering and somebody comes up to you and says, "Hey, BJ, what do you do for a living?" How do you explain it?
I tell them that I make bodies. I make dummies. We like you were saying, we do stuff for film and television, Halloween and haunted houses, and just all kinds of fun things like that.
So if we walked into the showroom in Madison of Dapper Cadaver, give us the sights, what would it be like?
Sure. Well, our showroom, it's just a small part of the facility. Most of it is dedicated to our manufacturing, but our showroom's got some cool stuff in it, a selection. We've got bodies and aliens, also animals. We've done snakes and pigs and dogs and alligators. So it's not just people that we do, as well as monsters, killer clowns, zombies, vampires, werewolves. So just really any sort of, anything that has died or could die, we can make.
Does it ever creep you out? I mean, do you have the lights on before you walk in, or is this something you become accustomed to?
Oh, yeah. I don't like to walk through with all the lights off.
Thank you.
Or kind of do. I mean, it's a bit of a thrill if you turn the lights out and go through. Everybody gets creeped out sometimes. You know, we're all human, but I definitely have a different perspective on some things.
BJ and his wife Eileen own the specialty prop shop Dapper Cadaver in Madison. And how did you build up your reputation? How did you make the connections? How did you get into the business?
Sure. Well, I mean, I started when I moved down to Los Angeles. Prior to moving there, I had already worked in fabrication. I had already worked with some amusement parks. I had built some games, mostly. Was interested in getting into dark rides and other things that had like full characters and scenarios. And before that, I had worked in some toy design. So I'd done some work for, you know, Micro Machines and Estes rockets and other things on a small scale. And I wanted to, you know, I wanted to go bigger. I hooked up with a prop shop down there that took a chance on me and started building things. They did a lot of death related stuff, which I enjoyed doing. Made some zombies and headstones early on. Worked with him for a bit and then struck out on my own along with my wife Eileen. She had been helping me since the beginning. She's a great partner and does so much running the company.
Why you started in Los Angeles, but BJ, how did you and Eileen move Dapper Cadaver to Madison, Wisconsin?
Oh my God. Well, that was epic. We had to load everything up into trucks. I don't want to get too much into that, but that was pandemic related. Things were shutting down in Los Angeles and we needed to keep things rolling. And we've got we got family out here, which is why we chose here. And it's a good climate for casting rubber, actually. And so those are two factors that made us want to check out Wisconsin.
BJ, what are some of the creations, one of the creations that you're most proud of at Dapper Cadaver?
Oh man, there have been so many. We've done. I was just looking back at some of the stuff that we've done over this year itself, and some of the fun ones that we did. We did an escape room that was like 1920s themed, and so everything was in black and white, and so we did a series of figures. and a series of like butcher shop, like pigs and meat and things like that, all in black and white, which was a fun challenge. We did a crazy thing for a Scream Park in the UK, Nightmare Realm UK, that like it was this woman creature with wings and exposed bones and just absolutely over the top. Loved doing that. You know, we did for Shark Week this year was fun. We had to make a pig that could float out to sea like a boat if the sharks would go after it. It was attacked by 20 sharks.
Wow.
20.
Congratulations.
It lost two legs and a bit of lower jaw, which I think means it fared better than I would if I was attacked by sharks. So I was proud of how strong we built that.
Is there any, are you ever left starstruck by one of your props where you're like, oh, wow, our body is interacting with blank?
Oh, definitely. You know, it's always fun to see our stuff in television. It's always fun to see our stuff in movies. It's always fun to see our stuff in haunted houses. You know, we'll do like a walkthrough, you know, with like Universal Studios or Busch Gardens or one of the places like that. And we'll be, oh, look at that's one of ours. Or our crew members will go to different places and they'll send back photos of the things that they saw. And yeah, and we'll see things. Actually, one of the things I was excited to see, we did some stuff for What We Do in the Shadows. We've been working with them since season one. And we built a few years ago this really goofy vampire bat that has like a 4-foot wingspan. We did it for a guy who intentionally wanted it goofy. It was a custom build. And you know, we'd done it. We'd built it a few times since then. And they called and they said that they wanted it, which was just absolutely perfect. Because again, it's like, this is not super scary. It's kind of a weird piece. And it was like, oh, great. Vampire
perfect.
Comedy.
Perfect for What We Do in the Shadows.
That for.
Finally, BJ, what does Halloween mean to you? It seems like every day is Halloween for you. So is this season something special or just another day of work?
Not every day is Halloween. Halloween is just, it's like February 1st through November 5th. the rest of the year is not Halloween. This is just so much fun. I love seeing everybody just decorating all the homes and businesses. And, you know, I've always loved the thrill of a good scary movie. This is just a really fun time for people to get together, show off, you know, their costume and their makeup skills. I've got, you know, our it's always great to see our crew. I have a very talented crew. Some of which are Wisconsin natives, other which are people who moved to work here. And, you know, they do, a lot of them do fantastic makeup and costumes as well. It's always so much fun.
Awesome.
It's just the most fun. Why not?
Hey, BJ, happy Halloween.
Yep. Happy Halloween.
BJ Winslow, co-owner of the Madison-based specialty prop shop, Dapper Cadaver. Now, it's time for Wisconsin Life, and here's producer Mary Kate McCoy with a story about an animal sanctuary.
Primate research has led to countless scientific breakthroughs. But when a monkey is no longer needed for research, what happens next can be an ethical quandary. In South Central Wisconsin, a team runs a sanctuary for monkeys as a way to say thank you for their contributions to science. Jana Rose Slice brings us the story.
There's a small animal sanctuary tucked away in a quiet rural area in Marquette County. Here, you'll find 9 monkeys living in habitats close to their natural environment.
That's actually Bella doing a warning call, saying stranger danger, there's visitors today. But she likes to let the other monkeys know what's going on.
That's Amy Kerwin, executive director and founder of Primates, Inc.
And then Jojo on the right, he's a green monkey. He's just 1 year old.
The monkeys living here were former research animals or pets. Kerwin used to work with 97 rhesus monkeys in a University of Wisconsin-Madison lab. She loved caring for them as they were used for biomedical research.
You know, some labs don't want your employees to grow close to the animals, but since the monkeys are so like us, it's almost inevitable. You're gonna grow close to them, so why not help facilitate and give a chance so they can give back?
Kerwin has set out to do just that. When an animal is no longer needed for research, it has few options. It costs thousands of dollars for one monkey's retirement care.
It costs just hundreds of dollars to be able to euthanize a monkey to free up their cage or sell them to more research than you actually make money. So the motivation to retire is an ethical compromise.
After learning about the barriers monkeys face getting into retirement, especially in Wisconsin, Kerwin decided to make a change. She started Primates Inc. so the retired monkeys can live their lives as close to their wild counterparts as possible. It's also a way to thank them for their contributions to science. Fallon Mullen also used to work with monkeys in a research lab and is now the animal care manager at Primates Inc. She's responsible for the day-to-day care of the monkeys.
This is Mars. Just turned 16, like I said. He is a rhesus macaque male as well, also from the biomedical industry, and he's paired with Timon, who everyone calls Sweet Timon because she's just so kind of timid and really, really sweet-natured.
Many of Primates Inc. residents have never lived in their natural environment. Staff maintain greenhouses, raised walkways, and indoor and outdoor spaces for the monkeys. Mullen says this encourages natural behaviors like foraging, grooming, and playing.
But we've never seen a monkey actually swim. They'll sit in the pool. The pools are, you know, like either like kiddie pools that you would imagine or like turtle sandbox, you know, about that depth. So not real deep. But the monkeys in the past have, you know, like I said, just sat in them, waited in them.
But Mullen says that changed when a pair of surrendered pets showed up.
But Noah, who is a rhesus macaque male, he is paired with Maddie. We just gave them their pool this month, and he can be seen actually swimming. So he goes under the water and does several circles and will come up for air, and it's just so amazing to see because he didn't learn this from the other monkeys here. So this was just like his natural instinct coming out, and also such a great story about why monkeys should have the opportunity for retirement. It's just so amazing.
Kerwin hopes to grow Primates Inc. to house 100 monkeys because she sees the impact retirement in a natural environment can have on former research animals.
Jana Roche Leis brought us that story about an animal sanctuary. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
Coming up, we're talking about quiet quitting. Is it being lazy or just doing your job? Next, here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn. And how many people have been talking about quiet quitting recently? You've probably heard it. According to some people's definition, you might be doing it yourself if you're following your job requirements and doing nothing more. While some people say quiet quitting is advocating for a work-life balance and not going above and beyond your pay or job duties, others say doing the bare minimum is just being lazy. Carla Miller is a work advice columnist for The Washington Post who's written about the concept of quiet quitting. Carla, welcome to Central Time.
Lee, thank you so much for having me.
Haven't we been quiet quitting for a while, and isn't by saying this out loud making it louder than it should be?
Yeah, quiet quitting, it's the term itself is relatively new, but it's not really that new of a concept. I mean, we've called it things like lying flat or working to rule, depending on how you define it. As you say, some people describe it as just slacking off, phoning it in, not giving an honest day's work for an honest day's pay. But I think the concept that people have been using it in, the context they're using it in recently, is more about not going above and beyond what they're being paid to do, not striving around the clock, you know, sort of rejecting that hustle culture that we've all sort of fallen into in the last few years.
So why do you think it's become so popular? How did this, I mean, it was a TikTok that caught steam for people who don't even have TikTok, and now we're all talking about quiet quitting.
Right, exactly. The TikTok sort of kicked it off and got everyone talking about it. And I think also a lot of people are just at a point in their lives, especially from the pandemic, especially those who had to work from home and were found themselves working around the clock, working longer hours than they would have been if they had to commute to the office. People sort of found their work life creeping into their personal lives. And I think this is a moment when a lot of us are stepping back and taking a look and saying, wait a minute, am I pushing myself too far? I'm feeling burned out. Do I really need to be working this hard to get the job done? It's not that people don't want to work. They just don't want to work any harder than is necessary or any harder than they're getting paid for.
Carla Miller, work advice columnist for the Washington Post. You write about quiet quitting, and then you get a bunch of letters from readers about quiet firing. And something that we have, that you have detailed in your columns, especially since the pandemic and this push to return to work.
Well, yeah, exactly. It's the other side of the coin. People saying, well, if you're going to accuse me of not doing my job, what about the employers who are just doing the bare minimum for their employees that they're required by law to do, but not really giving them the feedback they need, encouragement? Some people are in jobs and they don't get raises for years. They're passed over for promotions. They're not given bonuses, but they're also taking on more work. For example, the people get laid off or people quit the jobs, and then the work gets distributed with the people who are left, and the management doesn't hire anybody new. So people are taking on even more work, but they're not getting more pay for it. And they're feeling sort of pushed out, maybe suppressed, ignored, dismissed. In some cases, management might even be intentionally trying to make the workplace unpleasant or uncomfortable for those people because they want to get rid of them, but they can't necessarily come up with a good reason for firing them.
Very interesting. But when I think of quiet quitting, I wonder, is this coming from a place of privilege? Is this something that it might depend on your race or your gender and your ability to just coast along?
That's quite possible. I mean, a lot of it, as we say, it depends on the kind of job you're doing. And I'm describing it in the context of remote jobs, which themselves tend to be fairly privileged. These are people who can work from home, do their jobs from home, and they're not being observed around the clock. Now, if you're doing a job where you're facing customers over a counter and you're having to meet their demands every minute, you need to be there when they open, you need to be there at close, and you have to be ready to jump and fill orders, that's a little different. That's not something that you can really quiet quit without drawing a lot of attention to yourself.
Carla, we got an Aaron from Hortonville called but couldn't stay on the line, but was wondering if this is just a fad, if this is something that will be gone in another year's time, or is this something that is going to make a lasting impact on our work-life balance?
I don't think it's going to be gone in a year's time. We might be calling it something very different, just the nature of the nature of social media and whatnot. But as I say, it's not a new concept. People often reach a point in their jobs where they're realizing, is this it? Isn't there more to life than this? Or do I really need to be striving? Do I want to be striving? Or can I just do the job that I'm being paid to do and then try to find balance with the rest of my life? And we've really been taking a hard look at what work means and what the purpose of work is, especially in the last couple of years. So no, I don't think it's going away completely. We'll just probably be calling it by a new name.
Well, and so what are employers doing to combat this idea of quiet quitting? Is there some sort of, do they have an answer to this?
Some employers are rolling with it and saying, hey, you're getting the job done that we're paying you to do. We're not going to micromanage. Some employers are going the opposite direction and they're micromanaging. They're maybe installing tattleware or spyware on computers that are owned by the company so they can keep track of how much people are clicking, how many emails they're sending, how much their mouse is moving, really sort of measuring productivity by those metrics, which is not necessarily a sign of how much good work is getting done. But the employers that can't seem to quantify what it means to be productive or don't have a good idea of how to measure people's work might be resorting to those measures as just sort of a way of indicating how engaged people are and how active they are.
Carla Miller, as I was reading your article, I was thinking, is this the end of hustle culture? Is this a change in trends towards hustle culture? But then I see this story also from the Washington Post about some remote workers are doing two jobs at once. Ars Technica had the story out just this weekend about how they surveilled 1,000 remote workers and had to fire 24 because they were working multiple jobs at once. So it's not like the hustle culture is going away, but maybe we're identifying what works for us individually. How do you see the folks who are handling two jobs without the other employer knowing it?
Yeah, and that's yet another aspect that has come out of this. And it's nothing new. People have been working multiple jobs for years, usually because they have to make ends meet or to get by. But again, largely because of the pandemic, largely in these jobs that you can do remotely, people are adopting what's being called overemployment, working two full-time jobs where they can actually do both jobs simultaneously, you know, switching from one computer to the other. Now, I mean, people have always been doing moonlighting, you know, or to having side gigs, that sort of thing, doing gig
side hustles, sure.
Side hustles, yeah. But this is a little different because they can do the 40-hour job, two 40-hour jobs in one 40-hour week. And a lot of them are doing it to get ahead financially so they can sort of build a savings cushion, maybe afford a house. And it seems like a lot. Some people are making it work. And again, the question comes down to, are they cheating their employers or are they actually able to get the work done that their employers are paying them to do without any conflicts, without, you know, again, without cheating anybody and without burning themselves out?
Work-life balance, employer-employee relationships, quiet quitting, quiet firing. We are at the cusp of something. Washington Post columnist Carla Miller joining us, and thank you for explaining it all this afternoon.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Carla Miller, work advice columnist for the Washington Post. Today she joined us to talk about the trends of quiet quitting and quiet firing and how not necessarily new, just a different way to look at it. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, former Senator Gary Hart joins Rob Ferret to explain how our American Republic can still save our American democracy. And veteran journalist Margaret Sullivan brings her with her a toolbox for newsrooms to keep the facts straight. That's tomorrow on Central Time. Coming up next, though, it's the news from NPR and WPR, and then a thought pops into your head. Is that thought a word? Is it a picture? Advocate Temple Grandin joins the show to share her new book, Visual Thinking, and why she says we're not doing enough to support people who have different thinking styles. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today, and you're listening to Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today, and you're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a new report from an education research group looks at the shortfalls in Wisconsin's special education funding. We'll find out how the system works in the state and how it could be improved. First, what's the last thought that crossed your mind? Maybe what you're making for dinner tonight or something you heard on the news just now? Whatever the thought was, how did you experience it? Did you hear it in words or did you see it as a picture or maybe as a series of pictures? If you saw the thought as a picture, well, you're in good, great company with our next guest. She's a visual thinker and says there are a lot of people like her who are inventors and artists and misunderstood. And in a world dominated by language, she says we need to get better at supporting people who think visually. Is this you? Join us, 1-800-642-1234. When you think about something, do you think in words or do you think in pictures? Why? What is it like to imagine thinking the opposite way? Is your school system doing enough to support different styles of thinking? 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Temple Grandin is a professor of animal science at Colorado State University. She's an advocate for the autism community and was depicted in the HBO movie about her life. Her latest book is Visual Thinking, The Hidden Gifts of People Who Think in Pictures, Patterns, and Abstractions. Temple, thank you so much for being with us today.
It's great to be here.
Let's start with the lack of awareness that we have about how people think differently. It should, I think, if you think about it, it should be obvious that thought is a spectrum like so much else we find in nature. Where's this lack of awareness come from?
Well, thought is definitely a spectrum. I started out my cattle behavior work, and I looked at what cattle were looking at, and things like shadows would scare cattle. Not that when I first started doing this in my 20s, now it's a long time ago, in the 70s, I didn't know other people thought verbally. I only thought visual thinking existed. And I do a lot of talks to big corporations about different kinds of thinking and how they have different skill sets. And I tell them that the first thing they've got to do is realize different thinking exists. There can be extremes, And then lots of people are mixtures of different kinds of thought. They can either be thinking in pictures, object visualizer, or thinking in patterns, more mathematical pattern and music thinkers, or verbal word thinkers.
So you were a visual thinker, Temple Grandin, and the dominance of language thinking had a big impact on your life. Share that with us.
Well, being an extreme visual thinker has helped me with designing equipment. In fact, object visualizers like me tend to be good at animals, art, mechanical things, and photography. Art and mechanics go together. And when I was out working on equipment, I worked with a whole lot of really smart people working in the shop that were probably autistic, dyslexic, or ADHD, extreme visual thinkers. Had a difficult time doing algebra, but built all kinds of mechanical devices for industry.
Temple Grandin, can you give us, and obviously I'm a verbal person, I'm verbalizing all the time, even when nobody's listening, so could you give us a little idea of what a thought is like inside your head?
It's completely in pictures. You know, when I mentioned the people that working in the shop, I'm actually seeing some of the metalworking shops I worked with. I'm seeing pictures of the people. I'm seeing some of the projects are kind of flashing up now, like a series of PowerPoint slides, or when I was younger, 35 millimeter slides.
And there are some great examples in your book, Temple Grandin, where this visual thinking comes into play in your life. And you detail how you are a NASA nerd and a space, you know, a space aficionado. And you got to visit Cape Canaveral and you got to see a SpaceX launch. But you also saw something on that launch pad that I don't think anybody else saw.
Well, that's the thing. There's two parts of engineering. There's a mathematical part of engineering where you calculate things, calculate the rocket's trajectory, orbits, getting the rocket to Mars, things like that. Then there's the visual thinking side of engineering. And we visited the launch pad. This trip was 5 years ago. That launch pad right now has a rocket sitting on it. And we were walking around under the launch pad, and I saw a little weird rapid motion, and I watched a raccoon go down a staircase and waddle into the bushes. He had been spending a night inside the launch pad. And then when I got a chance to go in there, I saw specialized equipment for rocket fueling that I don't really want a raccoon around, electrical panels, all kinds of things like that. And nobody else saw it. I saw it. And I called it to their attention. And I hope he's long gone now.
It's interesting because you see all the wires and you see all the technology, but perhaps you'll miss a little fleeting tail of a raccoon somewhere. Temple Grandin is our guest, and I just want to reintroduce you. Her latest book is Visual Thinking, and she joins us with how she thinks and how so many have thought in the past, and we just didn't even know it. What is it about the verbal-visual divide that has verbal dominating the way we talk about how we think, Temple?
Well, there's actually two types of visualizers. So there's the object visualizer like me, who's very good with art and mechanical things, who absolutely cannot do algebra. None of the shop guys I worked with could do algebra. And then there's the mathematical side of engineering. And in something like a big food processing plant, the mathematicians design the boilers, the refrigeration, make sure the snow and the wind loads aren't going to cave the roof in. And my kind of mind makes all of the clever equipment, mechanically clever equipment. Think packaging equipment, for example.
But also, your relationship with the animals, and you know, you conclude your new book with animal consciousness and visual thinking, and part of that has to do with your hypothesis that the tendency to perceive animals as completely other increases as verbal thinking predominates in both individuals and cultures. And that rang true to me, especially when I see people walking their dogs and dogs being yanked on their leash while they're just trying to smell a fire hydrant. Yeah, that made sense to me, Temple.
Well, an animal is sensory-based. I mean, the dog has a great smell world, for example, and it's a sensory-based existence. Now, I've worked with my great co-author, Betsy, who's totally verbal, and I learned a lot more about how she thought. I'd write rough drafts, and then she'd straighten them out and make them much more linear. But I think that if a person's an extreme verbalizer, I think they have a hard time imagining thought without words, whether it's mathematical kind of visualization or picture visualization like me. And And some of these arguments now about consciousness in a dog, for example, some of the people that still might not think a dog is truly conscious probably are extreme verbal thinkers. And lots of people are in the middle road on different kinds of thinking. They're combinations. I discuss animal consciousness, and I just read a trippy paper after the book went to press, done at Cornell University, that the dog has an internet circuit from the nose to the visual cortex. And I'm going, wow, smell pictures? He smellulizes, and the smells are going to the visual cortex? That was very trippy.
It's smell-o-vision for dogs. But this, and where we started Temple Grandin, and you also talk about, don't pull you should recommend stop yanking dogs' leashes when they're trying to smell around a tree or a hydrant, because they're communicating. It's, as you call it in your book, P-mail.
Yeah, it's their communication. And, I think the first step is realizing that different thinking exists, and we need these skills. We are actually losing skills. There's things we don't make in this country, such as the state-of-the-art electronic chip-making machine for electronic chips. That's because we took out shop classes 20 years ago. Another big mistake that companies made is shutting down in-house engineering, and that happened in the meat industry. It's coming back to bite them right now. But right now, if you want a new poultry processing plant, how about 100 shipping containers from Holland? Well, we're paying the price for taking the hands-on classes out of the schools. Holland did not do that.
So, and to go back to animals for a second, before we move on to education, and as you refer to it, the failure to launch for kids who may think differently than is commonly accepted, that we talked about thought as a spectrum, but to get back to animals for a second, Temple, consciousness could be a spectrum as well then, correct?
Well, there's visual consciousness, there's verbal consciousness. But the thing is, all I can say is that there's some people are mixtures of photorealistic visual thinking, object visualization like me, the mathematical pattern thinking, and thinking in words.
Yeah.
I'm an extreme object visualizer. For me to think about something, I have to have a picture. And if you want to kind of get an idea of how I think, why don't you give me a keyword? And don't give me something that commonplace that most people can visualize, like house or car.
All right, Rubik's Cube.
I'm seeing it. I'm also absolutely couldn't do the Rubik's Cube because that's pattern thinking.
Okay.
But I see it, and I've also seen it disassembled and what it looked like disassembled.
So would we have a better understanding? Do you think, Temple, we would have a better understanding of animals if we had a better understanding of visual thinking?
Well, the first thing is you have to realize that visual thinking exists.
Yeah.
I have talked to a highly verbal person that got her first dog, and it taught her so much. I said, watch what your dog does. What is he attending to? And she got a lot more insight into nonverbal thinking, watching what her dog does when it was running around in a field.
It makes sense. We're talking to Temple Grandin. She's an author and autism activist who's with us today to talk about her latest book, Visual Thinking, The Hidden Gifts of People Who Think in Pictures, Patterns, and Abstractions. And we want to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234. Are there people in your own life who think in a different style than you do? You think your workplace could benefit from people who think differently? And if you're a visual thinker yourself, we'd love to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and right now we're picking up our talk with author and advocate Temple Grandin. Her new book, Visual Thinking, The Hidden Gifts of People Who Think in Pictures, Patterns, and Abstractions. We want to hear your thoughts as well at 1-800-642-1234, where John and Boaz is standing by. John, good afternoon. You're on the air with Temple Grandin.
Good afternoon. I would like to try to explain the visual thinking involved with an MRI CAT scanner.
How do you go about it, John?
Well, they roll you in the magnet. It has 1.5 Tesla strength. Very, very strong magnet where all of the hydrogen atoms of your brain align north and south with the magnetic field that's in there. Then they give you a radio frequency pulse to upset those atoms, and how fast they fall back into alignment tells if it's a bone or if it's gray matter.
So are you able to do this as a as pictures or short movies in your head, John, or is this come to you as words? And are those pictures, is that how you were able to do this, building these CAT scanners and MRI scanners for GE?
Yes, once you learn how it works.
I very much appreciate the perspective. And Temple, are we doing enough to support visual thinkers? And how do we identify them and support the way they think best?
Well, there's two types. And I think for the how the MRI works, you're more the mathematical pattern type thinker, where I've actually had a bunch of MRIs scanned. And I had a big fancy DTI scanning at the University of Pittsburgh. And I have huge visual thinking trunk lines in my head, huge circuits all over my head. Now I'm seeing some of those pictures. One of them appeared in the USA Today. It was really a mind blower. But I'm very concerned about getting screened out. Since I can't do algebra, I wouldn't be able to graduate from high school today. And when you look at a lot of things that people have invented in the past, things like grain harvesting equipment, for example, that's an example of the kinds of things that get invented by people that are not good at math. You see, there's two types of visual thinking. I'm seeing smart math students being forced to do their math the verbal way, step by step, instead of letting them look at the formulas and just tell you the answers. And we need all these different kinds of minds.
Let's go to Rebecca next. Rebecca's in Newton, and she joins Temple Grandin on the air. Good afternoon.
Yes, hello. Thank you so much for taking my call. I'm a huge fan, Temple. I just have everything you've ever done. And I just want to...
Oh, we lost.
It's so funny that you were...
We're losing hello? Rebecca, but getting a siren. If you're hearing a siren right now, it's over the radio.
We've got a siren because we had a mistake on the time of the interview, and I'm in a parking lot right now instead of at home. I was told a half an hour different time.
Oh, I'm sorry, Temple. I am very sorry for the confusion today. And Rebecca, I'm sorry for the connection. Rebecca has a son who sees and thinks about math by just coming up with the answer. It's that aha moment that you write about, and Temple, in your book.
He needs to be allowed to do that. And he needs to move ahead into more advanced forms of math, like maybe high school math, maybe college math, calculus, algebra. Don't hold these kids back with the boring baby stuff. And they need the kind of math that's all numbers, not this kind of verbal math they're doing now.
And you're right. And this is a question that you ask to teachers, Temple Grandin, but I get the opportunity this afternoon to ask you. What would happen to some of our great scientists, inventors, and artists if they were in today's educational system?
I think it'd be a real problem. Einstein did not speak until age 3. Elon Musk has revealed that he's on the autism spectrum. Michelangelo was a little 12-year-old that dropped out of school. What would happen to those people today? I'm afraid they'd be just playing video games on a disability check rather than doing some of the great things they did. It's very important that young students get exposed to things. Michelangelo was exposed to great art and stone cutting tools. I myself as a child spent hours building kites, making things, loved to do all that kind of stuff, working with horses. Einstein grew up with his violin, and music, I think, was also really important to him. You've got to expose kids to things. I got interested in the cattle industry because I was exposed to it as a teenager.
Well,
that's how I got into it.
When you see kids who are, addicted to video gaming or can't get enough of it, I'm curious, does that suggest perhaps a visual thinking perspective? I saw a story today about an 18-year-old boy who just recreated our entire knowable universe on Minecraft, the video game Minecraft. And
let's get beyond Minecraft and... There's been a number of kids, young adults with autism, that got off of video games fixing cars. They found out motors were more interesting than video games. This Minecraft kid needs to be exposed to mathematics and all kinds of other things that he may find a whole lot more interesting.
Temple.
And you see, mathematics and art, they go together. I made a mistake here. Mechanical things and art go together. I made a mistake. It's mechanical things and art go together. But we need to get that child doing building with real things.
Temple Grandin,
working
our guest.
Computer programmers.
She is the author of the new book, Visual Thinking, The Hidden Gifts of People Who Think in Pictures, Patterns, and Abstractions. And you can join us at 1-800-642-1234, where Colette and Eagle River are standing by. Colette, you're on the air.
Hi. I think we're keeping kids who are visual thinkers out of college. I was allowed to go to college. I'm a visual thinker, an artist, made my way through the creative arts, and I'm now retired. My son, who was profoundly dyslexic, brilliant, but the only way we could get him into college was sending him through tech school first and then transferring him in. I also have an autistic son, but he's more at home with the disability check. But he couldn't get into college anywhere because they wanted 4 years of math, including algebra, geometry, higher geometry. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't get math either. I passed algebra with a D+. I mean,
well, and it's Temple writes about.
Let them in.
Well, you see, the problem I have with algebra as an object visualizer is there's nothing there for me to visualize. And I'm seeing too many kids getting screened out. And the thing is, I tell business people, we need these skills. I don't know if I could graduate my school today. I'd have to get into industry the back door. And I've seen a lot of smart visual people do that in the meat industry. They'll get a job in the maintenance shop. 15 years later, they're project manager for a new plant addition, and they're designing and patenting equipment.
Temple Grandin, what can somebody like me, who is overly verbal, do to support visual thinkers?
The first thing is to know that they exist. Mm. It was a shock to me in my late 30s when I discovered that verbal thinking existed in my late 30s. The first thing is knowing that they exist, and they have different skill sets, and they can have complementary skills working on the same project.
And it's interesting because our technical director, Sarah Hopeful, this afternoon when we were talking about this conversation, said, hey, I'm a visual thinker. But it was an aha moment that she hadn't thought about it before, because we don't think about how we think. So how do we get other people to start thinking about how they think, Temple?
Well, the whole purpose of writing the book, Visual Thinking, mm-hmm. was to get people to think about this. And I have a whole chapter on skill loss. I have a chapter on visualizing disasters. You need somebody like me to design the safety systems for Fukushima, because the reason why the Fukushima nuclear power plant burned up is they had no watertight doors to protect the electrically driven emergency cooling pump from the tsunami. Engineers, mathematicians calculate risk. I can see it. They just didn't see it. Simple, watertight doors, and it would have not happened.
I am curious about one of the issues that we have here in Wisconsin, Temple Grandin, are these CAFOs, concentrated animal feeding operations. You are an animal scientist who sees the world of animals in ways that verbal thinkers like me do not. How do you see these concentrated animal feeding operations, or CAFOs, how do you view them?
Well, I've written about this quite extensively in another book, Animals Make Us Human. Some of them, the animals are too crowded. There's some things that need to be improved. But on the other hand, it's not all one monolithic thing of badness. There's things that need to be improved, very, very definitely. And we need to work on improving some of those things.
Temple Grandin, you came to, and I thank you so much for being here today, but you came to our forum, which has to be verbal because it's all we have on over the radio waves or online. But how would I come to your level? Can I become a visual thinker if I'm a verbal thinker? How can I adapt?
I don't think you're going to take me and turn me into an algebra specialist. That's not going to happen. I think they'll know extremes of visual, verbal, and mathematical thinking. I think a lot of that's innate. Lots of people are mixtures. Now, you probably, if I ask you, I'm going to assume you're at the radio station, mm-hmm. think about your own house. I'm going to assume that you can see that. Mm-hmm. Most people can. And just knowing exists, and a lot of people that are verbal can, see some images. But there's it's where they really are different are more in the extremes, where for me, algebra was an absolute total barrier.
Yeah. And Temple Grandin, I want to thank you so much for sharing your story with us today and challenging us to change the way we think about thinking. Thank you.
Well, it's great to be here.
Temple Grandin, an author of the new book, Visual Thinking, The Hidden Gifts of People Who Think in Pictures, Patterns, and Abstractions. Coming up after the news, we'll talk to the author of a new report exploring the challenges Wisconsin faces when it comes to funding special education, and we'll look at potential solutions. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.